I'm the curator here at the Drawing Center, the curator of facts. You're looking at what is now, I think, the fifth or sixth iteration of the exhibition, and about two-thirds of the show is actually on this table, which you won't get to see tonight. And I just want to quickly go around the room and tell you what everything is, since Taba is ostensibly here because she has a piece up right now. So starting with the wall text, the first piece is by Seth Price. Following that is Taba's piece, which is a fax onomatopoeia. It's actually a transcription of the sound that the fax machine, which is located in the center of the room, makes when it transmits information. Those are three pieces by Edward Tufte. Below that is a letter about fax machines by Hans-Erik Obrist, Barbara Bloom, Cecil Balmond, and Rem Koolhaas. Claire Fontaine behind us are a series of sonnets by Michaelis Piekler, Wade Guyton, Marissa Gonzalez, Matt Sheridan Smith. Rachel is standing underneath the Christopher Williams hotel confirmation pages. Three photographs by Wolfgang Tillmans, a diagram of the possibility of time travel by Ronald L. Mallette, a series of notes by Joseph Grigley, and two pieces by Dan Graham. So this is about the fifth or sixth iteration. The show will sort of transform itself before it travels to a series of other museums. But we're very, very pleased to have Taba Auerbach with us tonight to talk about her practice and maybe a little bit about her contribution to the exhibition. My particular interest in Taba's work and in her inclusion had to do with a conversation we had about a generation of artists really working with the idea of knowledge, in particular the difference between information and knowledge, and moving away from what we may describe as image-making or media-based work towards a kind of trying to understand what is often deemed the ineffable experience of art-making and looking at art as a kind of knowledge practice and integrating other forms of knowledge within that practice. So please welcome me in joining Taba Auerbach. I should also add that this itself is an imperfect knowledge system. Okay, let's start again. Let's try that. And then I'll stop it. Okay.
The moment when I understood different sizes of infinity for the first time, and I think it was 14, and I had breakthroughs, and I was in math class, and my math teacher had just gotten done playing the harmonica, and he was sitting in a lotus position on his desk, on top of everything else, and he said something about it in passing, and I had that kind of like record speech moment, where you're like, what? That's impossible. And infinity was the biggest thing. How could there be different sizes? Anything smaller would be infinity, and it's an absolute. And I remember asking about it, and my just general stance was that it was impossible. I mean, this logical argument for it, and I don't really know whether to be presumptuous, like in either direction. So I'm just going to explain it the way it would be explained to me again, because it's not obvious. But if you look at a ruler, there are inch markings that are made in red. Imagine extending a ruler off in either direction infinitely. You can all agree that there are going to be an infinite number of. You can't hit? Is that what that means? What's your intention?
Yeah. How was that? Okay. Okay, so on this ruler, there are red inch markings, and it's funny hearing my voice reverberate through the room. If this ruler went off infinitely in either direction, there would be an infinite number of red inch markings on the ruler. Then if you go back to the finite ruler, you can see that there are also all these 16th inch markings in black, and we can agree that there are a lot more of them than the red lines. And if we extend it off infinitely in either direction, there are going to be an infinite number of black markings as well, but there's going to be a lot more of them than red markings. So those are two different sizes of infinity. And you can think about it also like if you threw a dart at this infinite ruler, like how likely would you be to hit a black line versus a red line? But the moment when I kind of wrapped my brain around that was this big sort of cognitive jump for me. It was like something that I thought was impossible was proven possible, and something that I thought was one of the biggest ideas just got bigger and more complicated and more nuanced. And I felt like I had sort of transcended my own like previous cognitive ability from a second ago. Oh, what's going on? Oh, okay. Do I just need to kind of touch it here and there? Okay. But this had sort of an ecstatic quality for me, like the way I imagine people feeling during some kind of spiritual experience or like religious or something in church, like that I've never felt. And I just felt like it's related to the way that I feel about artwork too, that I feel like art has a unique power to help you transcend what you thought you could conceive of or what you imagined was there and was conceivable in general. I read an interview with John McCracken recently. Is that right? Where he talks about a lot of sort of transcendent things. He believes that the aliens walk among us and that there's time travel and extra dimensions. And actually, in his conception of time, all time exists simultaneously. Not only the past, present, and future, but multiple pasts, presents, and futures all happening all at once. And we as humans are just sort of limited perceptually and have to experience just one and experience it in a linear fashion. And when I read about that, I was reminded of this drawing I made a really long time ago. It was an announcement for a show. And what I was thinking, I had just read Slaughterhouse-Five, and there's some aliens in there that actually can see all time, all the time. And I was sort of marveling at how the word "the" could change this phrase to give it this sort of like bigger and contradictory meaning. So I thought of that. But McCracken tells this story in the interview that I thought was really interesting and kind of contains this moment that I associated with my infinity moment. It was a story about getting off the bus his last day of high school and standing by the side of the road, kind of in the country, and looking off into space and thinking like big thoughts about the universe and like pondering the nature of things and where he fit into it and you know, is there a God? Is there a higher power? And he had this distinct feeling that he was being watched, and not just abstractly watched, but from a particular vantage point from above and behind him. And he describes it as like a spiritual, comforting, positive moment. And that happens, and like 15 years pass, and he's sitting around one day as an adult in this sort of contemplative mood, and he recalls this experience, and he describes kind of bringing the memory like into focus, and he realizes that it's coming into focus and he's observing himself from the exact particular vantage point from which he felt watched at that time. And there's sort of this lightning bolt between his present and past self, and he's perceptually rubber banded back and forth between these two states. And it's sort of like time just connects in a circle for him, and it doesn't really violate any laws of logic. It like makes complete perfect sense. So if you'll follow me on a little jump to the monolith in the 2001 Space Odyssey, it it looks very McCracken-esque. This monolith sort of represents these pivotal moments of cognitive leaps as well, like technology becoming conscious or evolution happening where apes are using tools for the first time. And I think of language this way as well, as a technology and as something that's actually affected cognition and thinking in general. So this is my little answer to it. That's the entire alphabet typed on top of itself. And I have a detail. I think I have a lowercase one too. So this is everything that you could say or write all in one little weird blob. And it's sort of the material for everything. So it's kind of reductive and it's kind of expansive at the same time. And I feel like that is like a contradiction, but in this image or shape, that contradiction becomes an agreement. The whole alphabet. So this is how that looks really funny. It's a square. So after thinking about this for a long time, and I also painted signs for a long time, so I was painting letters for years and like thinking about first letters and their forms and thinking about words, and it just became this whole weird like conceptual unraveling after a while. I started to think about where this language technology fails. And we all know that in a really intuitive way. Sometimes it just feels like words are not enough, and like they're sort of discrete things, like the red lines on the ruler, and our thoughts and feelings are just much more spectral, like the wood the ruler is made out of. And it just, sometimes I feel like we're sold a little bit short by language. And so I started to think of ways that I could sort of use it to disprove itself. And this is the cover of a book titled All True, where I use the property of transitivity, which should be my next slide, this principle, A equals B, B equals C, therefore A equals C, to prove that yes equals no. And I just had to reorder these, so I hope they're all in the right order. I consulted a language authority, the thesaurus, and these are all from the thesaurus, so they're all true. And through little incremental steps, we get a very big distance. So there, there you have it. Oh, thanks. When I showed this book to people, a lot of people thought it was depressing and like pessimistic, and I think it's really optimistic. Like a world where you can prove that yes equals no and everything is the same is like really exciting and like comforting to me. And I don't know if I'm alone in that, but I guess ultimately this is all about manipulating language for my own happiness on some level, but I think we all do that. So I did these little experiments in a lot of different ways. This is another way of going through small incremental changes to get a big distance. And it doesn't take that many steps. And I made a series of paintings that are anagrams, where one phrase, where both phrases have the same letter. So just rearranging the same group of letters to say something perhaps opposite or with some kind of fraught relationship. Or sometimes rearranging the same materials, like my hands, to say these two opposite things. Oh, I'm sorry. I guess that's it. That's just weird, but I'm sorry. Is that better? Okay, thanks for telling me. Wait, let me go back to this one. Oh, this is, these are letters, numbers as letters, so 0 through 9, but in the form of letters instead of numerals. And this is the entire alphabet built around sort of a matrix like you see on your digital clock, starting at the center with A, and then moving outward, like A is orange, and then you can see a lowercase blue B, and it moves outward from there. So sometimes, sorry? Can I say something? I think everyone's telling me to move or speak up. And then instead of collapsing things inward, sometimes blowing them outward, like dividing everything up into strokes and doing that in the order that I was taught to do them, like the right way in school. And then I got to this place where I had to consider the most prevalent language, which in the world, really, which is binary. Oops, this is not in the right order. binary, which is the language used for all digital technology. And I think it's interesting that our most advanced technology is based around a language. That's really just what it is. And I wanted to think about what was getting lost or added and how this was qualitatively affecting the world. And I also noticed in my research that, well, binary is basically zeros and ones, or really it's a signal and then the absence of that signal. So it's kind of just one thing. It's not even really two things. And I noticed that the same was sort of true about cuneiform, which is the earliest written language that we found. It's made by pressing a wedge-shaped stylus into a piece of clay, and it's the same mark. It's just oriented and grouped differently, and that's basically what we do with zeros and ones. So it's very advanced and very elemental at the same time. But the main flaw or characteristic that I found in binary is that there's no fundamental ambiguity. You can simulate it, but you have to simulate it by jamming a bunch of these unambiguous parts next to each other really closely and then kind of zooming out. And that's what digitizing images or sounds really depends on, is this sort of zooming out, so we just don't detect the units or the fact that we're looking at an alphabet with like one letter. And I made this series of 50-50 drawings. They're exactly half black and half white, and basically this is me drawing the same gray over and over and over again, but many, many different ways. And you can see when the units are smaller, it's a more convincing gray. I don't know how many of these I have. And another thing I noticed while doing this was that even though I was these sort of quantitatively summed to the exact same thing all the time, there was a qualitative difference. Like ambiguity and neutrality are not interchangeable, and so there was sort of a different spirit or character to each of the drawings that I ended up doing. I think this was my favorite one that I did. And so then after doing tons and tons of these patterns, I wanted to do the opposite and try to find the total absence of pattern. And that in itself would be like a binary, like pattern in the absence of it. And so I drew the same grid, and then I rolled a die to determine whether I would fill each square in black or white. Oh yeah, and then I did another series of drawings with my eyes closed and just process colors, cyan, magenta, and yellow. And here is one of the results. Maybe it's a little ugly. I didn't have control. So I did a lot more research about randomness, and this became this like quest for me to try to find it somewhere. I talked to a lot of people about it, and it's actually a lot harder to find than one would think. I mean, you'd think it would be sort of the default, but it doesn't really seem to be. And John Cage looked for it in various places. It's like it's been a challenge for a lot of people. And it kept coming up that television static was like an authentic instance of real randomness that we could depend on. And the reason for that is that snow that you see is actually background microwave radiation from the Big Bang. So we're seeing particles cooling from the Big Bang, which is alone pretty exciting. So I took a lot, like hundreds of pictures of my television. And this is as close to random as it got. I was really surprised by the results. More often I'd see things like this. I mean, this perhaps there's like an actual image coming into focus or going out of focus. But things seem to sort of collect around different nodes or different striations, and there are these sinusoidal patterns, and a couple of them looked like my 50-50 drawings. What just happened? So maybe the last pairing is a good example. In looking at this, I was thinking a lot about what is potential information, what's real, viable information. Like, where is the threshold for that? And where does this become something? And then what is that something? And because it's just the same stuff being rearranged. It's not really changing in any way. And getting at that threshold became another sort of goal for me, like akin to when maybe if somebody asks you to like taste something really disgusting and for a dollar and you say no, and then they say like, if I paid you $100,000, would you do it? And you say definitely yes. And then they say, well, what about $99,000? And then you just go, you know, like incrementally back from there, and where do you stop? And that kept coming up when I looked at these. I think that's the last one. So this led me to look at actual objects that I felt treaded on a threshold like that. And this is the Menger sponge. It's a fractal object. And you create it by doing this. You take a cube, and you divide each side into 9 squares, and so you end up with 27 cubes, like a Rubik's cube. And then you remove the middle cube from each face and the center cube. And then you keep doing that to each cube that you subdivided it into forever and ever and ever until it becomes this like 3-dimensional lace. I think I have a better picture. What's special about this object is that it occupies 3 dimensions, but it kind of behaves like it's just shy of 3-dimensional. I'm worried that I'm not going to do a great job of explaining why, but when you iterate it volumetrically, like when you take a 1x1x1 Menger sponge and make it a 2x2x2 Menger sponge, it doesn't grow by a factor of 2 to the 3rd, like a normal cube or a normal 3-dimensional object would. It grows by a factor of 2 to something like the 2.71 decimal places off into infinity. So I thought that was an exciting prospect, that something could kind of straddle these dimensional states. And what does that mean about those states at all? And if something could sort of straddle those two states, then maybe there could be a way to bridge the randomness I was looking for with the order of the work I was doing before. And so I kind of landed on this series, the Shatter series. I thought of shattering glass as a way, as a gesture of randomness. I mean, it's not totally random. The glass has, you know, stronger and weaker spots, probably. But I made these paintings by putting a panel on the floor, putting a piece of glass on top of that, and then a piece of cardboard on top of that, and smashing it through the cardboard. So I couldn't see what was going on and make decisions about where to hit it. And after that, I remove one shard of glass at a time and spray a half and half black and white gradient through in the space that is left behind, and do that to the entire thing. So there's this systematized way of applying the paint, and then a, a random or unordered composition to the piece overall. And then theoretically, it should be exactly half black and half white. And I'm thinking, well, I make mistakes, but then I'm likely to make mistakes in both directions, so they'll just cancel out. There was another one. That's out of order. Sorry about that. In fact, I even forgot to fill in one of the spaces on that one, but then I overfilled another area, so I'm good. Did that come across? These look really, really weird on screens, I'm sorry. So the other thing that I did as a gesture of randomness was to crumple paper. I just thought on my like dinky human scale, these are things I could do around my studio. And so these pieces are made by crumbling the piece of paper, lighting it from the side, taking a photo, putting the photo on my computer, and then lowering the contrast until it's almost imperceptible, and half-toning it. So just creating this grid of differently sized dots. So that the crumple is random, and I don't have any deliberate control over it, and then it's illustrated with a grid, like the most ordered, our convention for order. And when you stand really close to these, you can't see the image at all. I mean, it looks like this, and you look at this surface. So if you're to think about it, like you and the piece combined are, when you stand close to it, you're a pretty planar object collectively, and it looks really planar. And you look at the surface, and then when you back away from it, you and the piece collectively make a more three-dimensional object, and it appears much more three-dimensional. So you're kind of pulling it into space with you. And this was a way that I thought I could make something oscillate back and forth or be in some kind of squishy little middle ground between two-dimensional states. And this one is made by creasing canvas. That's the actual canvas that the painting is later done on. But this painting is flat. It's just a photo of creased canvas that I use. And here they are from far away. I think it's a little easier to see. They just get more resolved the further away you get, which is a reversal of how that usually happens. I thought maybe I could violate this randomness by duplicating it. So I crumpled two pieces of paper identically, and then found out that Tom Friedman had also done that. instead of being like angry or like irritated when you think you have an original idea and then you find out like someone else had it, I realized that my last slide wasn't there. Well, I realized that Tom Friedman and I are like two pieces of paper that crumpled identically. So I think that he and I remade the piece on a bigger scale. And that kind of made me happy, and it was sort of like the first moment that I told you about. So I think I'll just leave it there.
I it's very hard to resist wanting to ask you a couple of things. You often mentioned before when we've spoken and also tonight qualitative, quantitative distinctions. And something that often comes up in conversations with artists, with McCracken and with his work, is the idea of a qualitative experience versus a quantitative experience. And so many of the things that you're interested in stay in the realm of quantitative. They're dealt with as quantitative ideas, that, you know, that the modeled object is actually about the mathematics involved. But you seem to always find a either relatively poetic or qualitative aspect to it. I guess I was just wondering, does that sort of feel natural to you, or is that part of a larger idea of in a sense, what aesthetic modalities of understanding can do. That art making, in a sense, is always about a qualitative experience rather than a quantitative experience.
I feel like it is.
You're still on.
Oh, okay there. Yeah, I feel like it inherently is, but then I also think that some of it is just specific to me, like the way that I get. I've for a long time felt like, oh, I'm this really like mathy, logical person, and I like spirituality is this bogus, new agey kind of stuff. And recently, I've just been realizing that that's kind of the same thing to me. Like I got to that sort of ecstatic moment through this really logical, quantitative series of thoughts. And so those things merge, and there just really isn't much of a distinction for me. And that. Those experiences are kind of ecstatic and in the same like squishy emotional way that I think that looking at that art is for a lot of people, even if it's, you know, not emotionally driven or about like things that happen in my life or narrative or anything like that.
Mm. So it seems to, it's often a, but one of the interesting things about this show is trying to explain the idea to people who work in other fields of practice. And I think for artists, it's very intuitive that even just the idea of what the mistakes that can happen in the transmission, and for, say, a theoretical physicist, he couldn't quite understand why. But I think that there seems to be a repressed, I mean, we've also talked about, I think we're both fascinated with, for example, the discovery of DNA and DNA modeling, which had more to do with actually building a model of it. Mm-hmm. Because Watson and Crick are not particularly good at math. And so that kind of tinkering or that kind of playful way of approaching physical objects and the descriptive systems or demonstrative systems that they represent seems to be something you're very interested in. At the same time, there's this other part, which is this authorship issue, mm-hmm. which is comes in very early in your work, that there's always a kind of generative part to what you do. And it's even when it's labored, it still has a kind of, you're there but distant. Is that something that you were sort of aware of when you started making art, that you wanted a slight removal?
No. It wasn't a self-conscious decision at all. It just is what felt natural to me. But I mean, I feel like there's further removal that I could have, like the crumple paintings could just be printed, but I just print the outlines, and then I, along with trusty helpers, fill them all in by hand. And to me, that's just a really different experience to look at that piece of art that people have labored over and spent their care and attention with. I think that gets transmitted. So maybe that goes a little bit against that step of removal that you're talking about.
Do you want to talk a little bit about sort of what you're working on for your upcoming show? Or, 'cause I know you're making large sculptural pieces, which seems like a...
How much to give away? I'm making a large instrument. I think that's all I'm going to say.
Okay.
And
is it functional?
Yes, and I'm going to perform with it with my collaborator on the project, my friend Cameron. And so I think it's important to see it played.
Oh, so now we know three things.
Yeah.
So if you just keep talking, we'll find out more.
Yeah, I'm not a good secret keeper for myself. And yeah, I can tell you I'm making a sculpture about entangled particles, which are these photons that are separated from one another and then behave identically. You can stimulate one and the other one responds. And I've been just doing research about quantum mechanical phenomena and sort of mysteries that are left in science that seem like counterintuitive and
That goes back to your crumpled paper paintings, where there was a until about just after this the post-war period, there was a sense that we sort of finally understood something about the universe because we understood it on a macro level. And then and we thought, well, the smaller, we believed, I guess, since the 18th century, that the smaller you break something down, the more you'll learn about it. But when we did that, and we collectively got to the quantum level, it actually almost completely contradicted
totally
the macro level.
And yeah, you realize that scale actually is a huge plays a huge role in whether or not things just make sense. Like the logic on that tiny, tiny scale just goes out the window as we know it. And I think that's really exciting. It's the same part of me that's really happy that I can prove that yes equals no, that is happy that exists and that seems impossible and that we haven't yet made sense out of it is weirdly comforting to me.
Well, thanks for joining us. Thanks so much. Thank you.